The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Do you expect China just to yield all of a sudden? You know, China under the CCP, that's not going to happen. So what's victory in this? And that's a question that is really unanswered for so many of these conflicts. What's the end game for Iran? So you got us out of a deal. You didn't like the deal. Fine. But they're closer to a bomb than they were. They're more, not less, aggressive in terms of military aggression in the region. So what's the end game? And by the way, do you expect them to sit down at the table and trust the deal you signed? Right? Having broken the previous one, this is the unanswered question for so many of these places. Okay, it's fine to reset and be tough. Where does it take you?
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, August 10th, 2020. During the Vietnam War, Richard Nixon employed an unusual scare tactic in his efforts to reach a withdrawal. He led Vietnam to believe he was crazy enough to start a nuclear war, an approach he described as the madman theory. From his first days in office, President Trump has employed his own madman theory, from menacing North Korea with fire and fury to threatening withdrawal from NATO, leaving not just adversaries, but also U.S. allies and even his own advisors unsure of what he will do next. CNN's chief national security correspondent and anchor of CNN Newsroom, Jim Sciutto, has analyzed Trump's foreign policy through this lens and written The Madman Theory, Trump Takes on the World. I invited Jim back to the Virtual Jungle studio to talk about it all. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 10th, Jim Sciutto on Trump and the Madman Theory. Jim, what is the madman theory and how did it come to be specifically with one Richard Nixon?
So Nixon is the origin of this, but he's not, doesn't claim sole ownership, if you want to say that. But go back to early 1970s, depths of the Vietnam War, and Nixon instructed his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, to communicate in no uncertain terms to the North Vietnamese that the president was just mad enough to order a nuclear strike on North Vietnam. There are transcripts of the tapes of these conversations between Kissinger and Nixon, with Nixon even dictating the exact words and phrases Kissinger should use as he conveys that message. As it happens, Kissinger does relay that message to the North Vietnamese. It doesn't work. It doesn't cow them into giving up their positions. Of course, we know how those negotiations went and how that war ended. But Nixon's team would come to own the phrase, the madman theory. H.R. Haldeman talks about it in his memoirs, names it as such, as a way to keep your adversaries off balance, gain advantage, either in negotiations or in war. Now, 50 years later, we have a new president, of course, with a very new and unprecedented approach, you might say, to world affairs, with a madman theory of his own, but with some key differences with Richard Nixon, in that one, his, and this is based on entirely on interviews with folks who work for this president. This book is all based on current and former Trump administration officials. His, Trump's madman theory is by accident rather than design, the product of an unpredictable president. And moreover, is one that he unleashes not just on adversaries, but also on allies, NATO allies, South Korea, Mexico, Canada, and even his own staff, who find him unpredictable, communicate that to their counterparts, and have to kind of follow him, clean up the messes, react to his tweets, rather than build the policy before. So it's a very, so the book relates back to the history, but looks at how Trump has created his own less strategic madman theory.
So is it safe to say that, looking back briefly at Richard Nixon, that it was a very limited tactic in a specific situation in order to achieve a specific goal, whereas now it's much more of a wider feature of the personality of the president?
Exactly. And one that he claims and his loyalists claim to be of merit, right? You know, that this goes back to art of the deal, an art of the deal approach to world affairs. And Trump has articulated this. You know, you surprise the other side. You might come in with a last minute demand, but you might also be willing to make a last minute concession, all to get the best deal. The trouble is that when you look at the record and how it played out during his 4 years as president, Trump was just as likely to be unpredictable without a plan as he was unpredictable with a plan. And we see that play out with, look, for instance, at Syria, right? Two, not one, but two withdrawal orders from Syria delivered by tweet, mm-hmm. following conversations with the Turkish leader, with no plan to issue a withdrawal order and no preparation, no discussion, no situation room meetings, and so on. Just a gut feeling, a tweet, and a new policy all of a sudden. And then everybody else has to kind of follow up and figure out how to make it happen or not make it happen or water it down in some way.
Right. So almost like the difference between a madman theory as part of a strategy, and in this case, a madman theory replacing strategy.
Yeah, sadly. Yeah. It's a product of seat-of-the-pants decision-making, mm-hmm. That is a hallmark of this president and this presidency, sure. and one that has huge effects across government, because Trump has deliberately acted to undermine and dismantle the national security decision-making process, attacking mm-hmm. the institutions that deliver him advice, the individuals, ignoring it, dismantling some of the structures, putting acting secretaries in places of ones that are Senate confirmed. It's a whole, you know, and that has effects across government.
Right. We definitely will get back to the big picture here about the degree to which this is conscious strategy or not, but let's fill in some of the details and pepper in some of these stories, some of which, honestly, even us who follow national security closely may have forgotten, because there has been so much content when it comes to Trump's foreign policy actions in the last 3+ years. And I think one thing most of us have forgotten is that Trump's debut as president-elect on the world stage was a call with Taiwan's president. Remind us what happened there and how it shocked the bipartisan foreign policy consensus that had evolved across decades.
Yeah, this is one of those decisions, those actions that seems a million years ago, and I think a lot of people forget. And there were several in just the first few weeks of his administration. But here was the president speaking directly with the Taiwanese president and upending decades of U.S. foreign policy, the one China policy, right, that the one China the U.S. would deal with at that level would be Beijing. And the president kind of casually, glibly speaking directly to the Taiwanese president, and by most accounts, it seems, not realizing that this was upending that policy. Hey, I can talk to whoever I want to. And then seemingly retroactively owning it, and he and his advisors saying, well, that was always the plan. We wanted to unsettle China here and show them that, hey, you know, maybe the one China policy is not, you know, written in stone anymore. I tend to, based on my conversations, believe it was more a gut call that was justified in retrospect. as often, as you'll see in other decisions, often happens in this presidency, but one that you can argue was fitting still with his broader approach to China, which is to say that, listen, as far as China is concerned, everything's on the table now.
And that seems to fit in with something that, you know, one of your many interviewees told you. For this work, you talked with a range of people who were in the room where it happened, as it were, in various parts of the U.S. national security establishment. In this case, Sue Gordon, who had worked at the highest levels of the intelligence community, she told you about Trump, he is a confident decision maker. I've never met someone more convinced in his own rightness. Do you think this plays into that call with the Taiwanese president, that he seems to care little about second and third order effects, but more about what he feels at the moment?
Certainly to that decision, but a whole host of decisions in his presidency, from that call to Taiwan, to the withdrawals from Syria, to his seat of the pants decision to meet with the North Korean leader, not once, but three times, including, you know, the third time at the DMZ, you know, invitation via tweet, surprising many of his own staff, you know, that this was a feature, not a bug, right, in his presidency, just a way of doing things. And it's interesting, Sue Gordon is, you know, she's now sadly out, you know, pushed out by this administration, but decades in intelligence, and she speaks with such a sharp, insightful eye as to how the president operates. And look at some of her comments there as she goes further about his confidence in decision-making, because she describes her concern that the president is so confident, not only does he go with his gut over the advice of others, he often goes with his, what he wants the facts to be over what the facts are. You know, not just ignoring advice, but ignoring hard information presented to him, because he either doesn't believe that hard information or wants it to be a different way.
And yet she, like some others you interviewed, seemed to understand and seemed to convey that it is the president's right not to agree with his advisors. We elect a president. Yep. We don't elect advisors, but they all seem to have, maybe not their exact words, but certainly the feeling from the folks you talk to, they do seem to believe that it's important to have a president who recognizes and acts based on reality rather than wishes.
Yes. And that was the more disturbing takeaway from her assessment, right? Is that, yes, you it's the president's right to change things. And she even makes a point that, listen, you know, intelligence agencies have to, as do other institutions, bend to the president and you know, give him, if not the advice that he wants, right? They're going to give honest advice, but give him the tools and approach things in ways that help him make decisions, right? Except when that, you know, that advice or those facts contradict the reality, right? You know, and that's the worrisome part. I mean, I pressed her, I said, so tell me when, and she said, listen, there are times when we think things and there are times when we know things. And she said the more worrisome time to her is when we know stuff, you know, based on intel, facts, data, et cetera. And he still won't accept that. And she said, understandably, those are worrisome times. And you see that play out not just in issues abroad, but issues at home, the way the president digests information on the pandemic, for instance.
Yeah. Let's break that down a little bit, that process by which the national security bureaucracy has learned across many decades to get information to the president, to help any president make decisions, and then how that played out with this president. It wasn't long after inauguration, certainly within a couple of months, that then National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster came up with a new system, recognizing that the president wasn't reading these briefing papers that are provided to presidents-elect and presidents to help them avoid things like the second and third order effects of that Taiwan call. What happened? Talk about the preparation for the president before any foreign policy engagement and how they adapted over time to meet the president's style and try to make it work for him.
Yeah, this is a worrisome tale, right? And one consistent with other accounts we have of the president, how he digests or does not digest information. But McMaster, as National Security Advisor, he and his team realized that the president wasn't reading their briefing materials before meetings. They could tell because they would come in and when they told him stuff that was in the material, it was clear he was hearing it for the first time. So McMaster and team came up with an idea to boil it down in a way that they hoped would lead him to read it. So they boiled down the briefing materials to 3 bullet points on note cards, figuring this we can get him to read. So they tried that for a little bit, and they came to discover that he was only reading the first 2 bullet points and not making it all the way to the third. So they adjust again, and they start concentrating the most salient information in just the first 2, and then the third one became a throwaway bullet point. But even then, they discovered he wasn't reading even the first couple of bullet points.
Wow.
So they just kind of gave up and expected in those briefings that he would not have read. And listen, we've had many instances since then where we've seen and heard that the president does not read those briefing materials.
It's shocking, I mean, in some ways, and you certainly helped prep the ambassador in China when you served there. Often note cards are a useful tool for prepping the principals for meetings, usually to remind them of the points that must be made that they themselves have agreed they need to make, or to give them a response with formally coordinated language to something that is very contentious. But for a note card to be the entire briefing paper is truly remarkable.
It is. And here's the other thing. Beyond informing the president, it's also about getting outcomes from these meetings, interactions, et cetera, that fit with U.S. policy, right? I mean, I tell the story in there, and there's more than one of early in his term, he was meeting the president of Argentina. Before that meeting, his team explicitly briefed him that, listen, this guy's going to bring up OECD membership. Mm-hmm. We don't have them at the top of the list. You know, just be prepared to have to push that off. And Trump walks in the meeting and says, hey, I hear you want to be in the OECD. I'm going to make that happen for you. You know, deliberately turning U.S. policy around. Now, eventually, the president backed off that, did a favor for another South American leader. But you have decisions like that where the president not only ignores the policy, but deliberately reverses it. And then in more consequential form, you know, for instance, when he goes into a phone call with the Turkish leader, Erdogan goes in with no plan, no intention, mm-hmm. and certainly not his team recommending that he order a withdrawal from Syria, talks with Erdogan for a little bit. Erdogan kind of pushes him in that direction. The president says, yeah, fine, I'm pulling the troops out, to the surprise of everybody. So, you know, you brief to inform, you also brief to keep the president and the team and the country on a certain plan in line with its goals and policy, and the president would often upend that. So it has real consequences.
Right. Tell us what your reporting and what your interviews for this project have told you about President Trump's view of covert sources mm-hmm. to collect intelligence.
He doesn't like them and would be happy without them. And, this arose from a story that broke last fall about the U.S. having to extract its senior-most asset spy from Russia, a guy who had risen to the top of the national security infrastructure of the Kremlin. And the U.S. had to get him out in a very risky operation in 2017. Now, in the lead-up to that and in the wake of that, the president's discussion of a source like that and others was not that, goodness, what a loss, right? We've lost vision into, you know, the thinking and planning of one of our principal adversaries, but that better without him. It's bad for me. It's bad for my personal relationship with Putin. And it's an approach not confined to Russia. He had public comments about North Korea after Kim Jong-un's half-brother was killed, you'll remember, and then there was the revelation after the fact that he was a CIA informant. And then the president said, I'm not going to let that happen again. I'm not going to have someone spy on my friend Kim Jong-un, you know, not while I'm president, despite the fact that, as you know better than me, David, that's a key way of gaining intelligence to keep this country safe. But the president doesn't like it, doesn't see the value of it. But also, as so many things with this president, he looks at it through the sole filter, the sole prism of how it affects him, his personal relationships, and doesn't have a sense of the broader necessity of that kind of intel gathering for the safety of this country.
How does that square with the idea that otherwise a lot of his actions, at least retroactively, fit in, which is How does that square with his idea of America first?
Hmm. Well, this is the thing, and it's something I tested in this book, really, is first of all, what is America first, right? You know, I asked everybody I interviewed, and again, you know, critics and loyalists who serve this president, explain to me what America first is. The thing is, the way it has played out in 4 years, and this is a pretty universal description, and again, it's one of those classic Trump things where some people see folly, others see wisdom, but essentially he's transactional. America first is transactional. What are you doing for me? And it's zero sum too. So very little understanding or appreciation for the many benefits that aren't in dollar terms of, say, a decades-long alliance with Europe, right?
Right, right.
Well, if you're not paying what I say is enough for your NATO membership, then we're not friends, you know? Forget that we fought a war together, that we have shared interest in the rule of law, democratic principles, you name it. I see it through just this one zero-sum transactional point of view. And that, you know, America first sounds grand. At the end of the day, it's a very transactional, simplistic, one-dimensional relationship. And it plays out, I think it applied to friends and to foes. You know, he thinks that, well, if I can get Putin to scratch my back and I'll scratch his, right? And that's not that different from a relationship with Germany, you know, despite all that history. And in a way, actually, and I write about this a little bit, he's angrier at the allies than he is at the adversaries because he feels that we've been giving them a free ride, right? So they owe us more.
The allies should be more grateful, so they don't deserve our friendship in his mind, right?
And you got to read the section in there. I speak with Peter Navarro at length, and Navarro being, you know, a true believer in this, look at the way he describes a Canada, even. I mean, he questions whether Canada is really an ally of the U.S. And I said, Canada, really? The longest peaceful border in the world. They fought and died with us in, like, you know, a half a dozen wars, et cetera. He's like, yeah, well, they only do it in their own interests. And I'm like, really? You know, but you buy it. You know, you got to read it. My Canadian friends, I've directed in that section of the book, and they're alarmed. But as you know, it affects the policy. It has real effects. Listen, you know, we'll slap some steel tariffs on you, right? You know, forget the history. All's fair in love and war.
Yeah, many, many people have raised with me, and I suspect also with you, the question, why so few resignations from the national security and foreign policy bureaucracy? I mean, whether it's the policies, like seemingly overturning the policy with Taiwan and China or the Syria withdrawals, whether it's watching a president who can't process information beyond a note card and perhaps not even on a note card, a president saying, I don't want to collect intelligence against our adversaries to protect the country. Mm-hmm. On any number of these, there is an argument that principled officers of the United States government could be seen resigning en masse over this. Mm-hmm. And yet we've seen very few principled resignations. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. I mean, the exit normally is getting pushed out, right? As opposed to, although there have been, I mean, you know, Mattis, you know, among them, right? Listen, first of all, I think that a lot of people think that they're doing their best for their country. You know, I live in Washington, easy to be cynical here, and there are a lot of folks looking out for number one. But like you, I've met and worked with and seen in action a lot of people who truly believe they're doing their part for their country. And I do genuinely believe for a lot of them that they stick around because they think they can still make a difference, right?
Right.
So I think there is some of that. And listen, people are people, right? So there got to be some selfish motivations sort of thrown in there for some or others. But I've seen it. You know, I've seen where people believe they can still make a difference.
Right.
And with a president that they think that they can help contain his worst impulses, you know? Mm. If you look at the way the Syria stuff played out, and long section in the book on that, you know, in the wake of his two withdrawals by tweet, 10 months apart, you had folks in the Pentagon deftly moving to try to keep some, if not all, U.S. forces on the ground there to be able to continue the mission, to not totally abandon the Kurdish allies, to continue to hem in ISIS. First time around, They cut a few hundred, and they waited for the president's attention to turn, and it did, right? And they were able to stay. Second time around, they thought the gig was up, and then someone came up with the bright idea of, well, let's recast it as protecting the oil fields. That'll satisfy the president because he'll see an economic end in it, and that worked. And lo and behold, a couple years later, there's still several hundred troops there. Not the footprint that the U.S. military wants, but better than nothing.
Right.
So you see people finding, you know, is that fooling, manipulating the president? Maybe, you know, or is it just trying to find a way to fight for some space in the midst of what is a largely erratic foreign policy approach?
That's interesting because it's one coping mechanism rather than resigning is, well, I'll stay in place. And while not formally violating a presidential order, I will slow roll it or execute it in such a way to minimize the damage and hope that his attention goes elsewhere. And I think that's a good case of that you described there.
Yeah.
Another strategy that I think it was my former colleague at CIA, Mick Mulroy, who ended up as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. I think he mentioned to you in a different logic that, in his words, the mechanism of the policymaking is still pretty much intact at the lower levels. And it's essentially not much different between administrations. The strategy for a lot of countries, he says, looks the same as it did under Obama and Bush. That implies that for much of the national security bureaucracy that aren't focused on the things the president is focused on any particular minute, day, or week, that policymaking goes on largely as usual.
Well, listen, to the extent that it can't, right? I mean, because the thing is that over time, whether by being forced out or some resignations too, right? And several of the people I talked to in the book did resign, you know,
right.
Mulroy among them eventually, although he served out the term that he said that he would in that position, is that if you look at the big picture, the moves have been consequential from Trump, right? You know, yes, we didn't pull all the troops out of Germany, but we pulled a big chunk of them out, you know? And the question is, what precedent does that set? In South Korea, we didn't pull all the troops off the South Korean peninsula, but the president is holding that threat over the South Koreans' heads. And we know that he's capricious enough that one day he might wake up, particularly if he's reelected, and just do it. You know, we did cancel a lot of large-scale military exercises there, which have a real impact on military readiness. I speak about that in there. And then you look at the broader policy. We did, as a country, throw all our dollars into personal diplomacy for 3 years, which North Korea took advantage of to expand its nuclear program. You know, Iran, we blew up the Iran nuclear deal with all its faults. Iran's now closer, not further, from a nuclear weapon than it was when you started. So, yes, there are efforts to kind of hem it in, keep the barriers around the worst impulses that you can, but over time, real consequential progress. And then when you think, I mean, you listen to John Bolton, for instance, who served, of course, at the highest levels as well, who will say that, you know, if he is reelected, maybe you're out of NATO for good, you know? So there's only so much defense that you can do, even as that policymaking takes place at the lower levels.
Let's dig a little deeper into one of those storylines. I think the two storylines you talk about in the book that best illustrate this, to put it kindly, this personal presidency, or perhaps this madman theory. One of them is the Ukraine scandal that led to his impeachment. And I think certainly most listeners here are very familiar with a lot of the details there. But then the other one is you devote a lot of attention to that saga you just mentioned, which has been U.S.-North Korea relations from fire and fury early on to an incoming missile that wasn't, to the love affair between Trump and Kim, or at least the perception one way of such a love affair. Drill down a bit on that and talk about how each stage in that North Korean back and forth reflected this manifestation of the madman theory.
Yeah. What we saw with North Korea was the madman with, you know, both his Jekyll and Hyde, right, to some degree. Because the first year of fire and fury, there was genuine concern in the Pentagon and elsewhere that the president might take the country to war. I tell the story about how in late 2017, at the height of the tensions, that the Pentagon hesitated to give the president military options because they were afraid he might use them and we might end up in a war. You remember this concept of a bloody nose strike? No one I spoke to in the Pentagon believed such a thing existed, because North Korea would reasonably look at any strike as the first of a decapitation attack, right? And then rain hellfires down on Seoul. So they did not consider that, you know, a reasonable course, and were therefore concerned that if they presented that as an option to the president, he might very well take him down that path. So here's the madman, in quotes, on that side. And then the pendulum swings to the other side, which is to say, you know what? I'm all in for face-to-face personal diplomacy, and my personal relationship with Kim, my love affair, can single-handedly move this mountain of North Korea. And three times, in Singapore, Hanoi, and then at the DMZ, and I was at each place. And 4 years later, and I end the book by doing a before and after on each of these things to see where we started and where we ended up. 4 years later, North Korea has more, not fewer, nuclear weapons, right? You know, they've got a more advanced missile program, not a less advanced one. So when you look at North Korea, Trump's madman, you know, sort of the madman in the war footing and the madman in the diplomacy footing, both of them failed to get where he wanted to get. And at the end, you end where, frankly, you know, two previous administrations, or three really, ended, which was, you know, North Korea played us. And they talked and then expanded all the time.
Interesting that you did not apply the madman theory to Kim, which would be an entirely separate project. But in a way, you could almost see Kim playing a version of this back to the U.S. president and winning over the last 3 years.
Yeah. It's interesting. And, you know, Kim is equally, capable of the bombastic, you know, remember Duddard, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, you know, the kinds of barbs that he threw Trump's way. And then on the other hand, the smiles and the handshakes and the inviting him across the border into North Korea. So he played that game pretty well. And again, if you look at the bottom line, he came out ahead.
Jim, you take great pains here to try to be as balanced and fair as possible while pointing out the hazards, the real risks of a personal approach to foreign policy that is not briefed adequately, perhaps, that does not take into account strategic or even some tactical consequences. But you take great pains to point out that sometimes it might actually work. And the one you mention here most notably is policy towards China. Not necessarily that Trump's approach has led to a good policy, but you seem to say that at least he has moved us away from a bipartisan consensus that has been a decades-long strategic failure. Walk us through that.
Yeah. It's interesting because this one is personal to me because I spent so much time in China, covering China, studying it for 25 years. And what struck me throughout that time, including my time in government, was this sort of reflexive deference that we had to China and its positions. And let's not upset them too much. And we don't want to go too far here, there. And my own gut on that, having seen a whole host of Chinese malign activities, from stealing U.S. intellectual property to its treatment of dissidents, et cetera, was, well, why? You know, they're not up at night thinking about our reactions to these things. You know, why can't we be tougher? And, you know, Trump, to his credit, said enough of that. You know, it's clearly not working. Let's push forward. And I start that chapter with a story of being inside the U.S. embassy in Beijing when at first the U.S. welcomed in the blind dissident Chen Guangchen, and then as his welcome wore out there. Yeah. And my feelings as that happened, where I'm saying, goodness, why? You know, why aren't we standing up for longer for this guy? Now, the trouble is, especially now, because we're in a period now where we are on a warpath, right, towards escalation on every front, and it's hard to get out of that kind of cycle, that spiral. What's the end game? Which is a consistent question for all these places. What is the end game for China? Do you expect China just to yield all of a sudden? You know, China under the CCP, that's not going to happen. So what's victory in this? And that's a question that is really unanswered for so many of these conflicts. What's the end game for Iran? So you got us out of a deal. You didn't like the deal. Fine.
Now what?
But they're closer to a bomb than they were. they're more, not less, aggressive in terms of military aggression in the region. So what's the end game? And by the way, do you expect them to sit down at the table and trust the deal you sign, right? Having broken the previous one, this is the unanswered question for so many of these places. Okay, it's fine to reset and be tough. Where does it take you?
And again, an interesting contrast with Nixon, who had a very, perhaps not realistic, but had a very clear plan of what he wanted to get from acting like the madman with the North Vietnamese.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you say, I do my best to hear and listen. What's the motivation here? And what did he change that needed to be changed? But also, like, what's the driving force behind it? I talk a lot to Steve Bannon in here about the politics behind America First. And Bannon makes the point that, you know, he talks about the deplorables. And Bannon says, listen, you know, the deplorables were victims of free trade, globalization, right? A lot of them lost their jobs, you know, which is on Democrats and Republicans for not looking at those effects over time. But he said then they had to send their kids to the wars. Mm-hmm. So they're, you know, in his words, they're getting screwed on both fronts. And you get that because who could claim that they've done well, you know, yeah, in the last 25 some odd years? Now, there are a lot of reasons for that. So you get that motivation. So what is the record of success you could present to them to say, this is why, you know, this benefits you? Now, what Trump doesn't get or doesn't want to get or doesn't try to explain to them is, well, okay, let's remember this system of alliances and so on have kept the peace pretty well for a number of decades, right? And the world without those alliances and this system, rule of law, et cetera, is not going to be that great for you either, right? I mean, that's the thing. It's like, what do you replace it with? If you can get the, mm-hmm, you get the animus that drives it, explain then to me, and this is what is lost in this, because I've asked everybody who worked for him to articulate it, explain then to me how you've made it better.
Mm-hmm. You do take great care to try to analyze all sides of this and even point out that he's certainly not the first president to have a mixed foreign policy legacy of some things that at least got us out of a rut, even if they didn't lead to something great. But you don't hold back in some places. And one, Jim, I have to push you on here. You write, Trump is uniquely willing to lie about it, referring to his foreign policy legacy. In your words, having examined all of Trump's foreign policy through this specific lens, talk through a bit about why it matters for U.S. troops on the ground, for our relationships with allies and friends, for the whole goals of foreign policy. Why does it matter that this president, perhaps uniquely, is willing to absolutely lie about the foreign policy of the United States?
Here's the thing. Soft power matters, right? It matters in so many conflicts. I mean, if you, Trump and his team are trying to evoke Reagan, right? Mm-hmm. Trump is Reagan-esque in his dealings with Russia and elsewhere. Reagan understood you needed both hard and soft power, right? You know, shining city on the hill, right? That matters in terms of showing that your system is better than that system.
Sure.
And people want to do business with you and they want to have alliances with you, right? And they generally trust your word. And again, I'm not whitewashing America's past over the last several decades, but you know, the thing is, and I write about this well, is that, you know, Trump is basic, his view is the end of American exceptionalism because he doesn't seem to buy it, right? Mm-hmm. One reason, it's interesting, one reason, folks, because I asked everybody, explain to me his love affair with Putin, right? And they say he just has a genuine admiration for Putin and a similar worldview, a somewhat nihilistic worldview that we're all the same. It's all zero sum. He seems to buy that. Is that, first of all, is that the vision that Americans see of their country? Mm-hmm. And two, do we not get that sticking to our values as best we can does distinguish, right? And does give you power and influence in ways that make a difference, you know, that are in your interest. So that when you have a president who lies, a president who attacks the democratic system, who attacks the vote, who doesn't seem to have great attention to following the law himself in his personal life or business, right? That has a loss on, not just domestically, but in the international sphere as well. Listen, I think it matters. You know, I spent a lot of time overseas. I don't think that that's purely idealism speaking. I think that it's also a look at recent history, that the U.S. has gained advantage by being different than the others to some degree. Mm-hmm. And he just doesn't seem to see that.
Yeah. So U.S. commanders-in-chief, presidents, are often defined by singular moments in their foreign policy and national security. You point out those can be iconic moments like Reagan's demand to tear down the wall. They can be consequential like Nixon going to China. They could be tragic like Jimmy Carter's experience with Iran. And of course, they can be deeply contradictory like most presidents' legacies on anything. Having looked at all of this, what do you think will be Trump's defining moment as a president operating in the world arena?
So he has a lot of them, and some of them, frankly, contradictory. So you have the Helsinki moment, standing next to the Russian leader 2 years after a unprecedented attack on an election, taking that Russian leader's word, saying, "I believe his denial." Just shocking, really, you know, on a number of levels, and hard to forget. And he took Republican grief as much as Democratic grief for that. On the flip side, if I could try to be as fair as possible here, you know, the walking across the border into North Korea, right, was something that no one would have expected years before, or even weeks or months before, and could have been something, right? I mean, the thing about, you know, the thing about diplomacy like that, you know, if you think, for instance, of Carter, Mideast peace plan, you know, you have the moment, but you also have to follow through. You actually have to make the agreement, right? You can't just have the handshake. You gotta make the agreement. And he had the moment, but not the agreement, right?
And that's the hard part, is the agreement that actually has teeth to it.
That's the hard part. So, listen, there were other successes, you know, the almost complete annihilation of ISIS, right? Accelerated, begun under Obama, accelerated under Trump, and if not done, because these groups can always come back, you know, completed, killing Baghdadi. I mean, these are things that are successes. But I think that one big takeaway from talking to folks is just the lack of follow through, right? Is that, yes, he'll have, if you take it back to the beginning, he'll have the phone call with the Taiwanese leader. But where is the China relationship today? Where have we gained advantage? Yes, you've stood up to them. Where have you gained advantage? He walked across the border into North Korea. Great. But did you make it safer? No, is the answer. And that's the concern.
But Jim, you see, walking across a border for a photo op is easy. Following through with the mm-hmm. details is hard. I mean, yeah. and maybe there's something to that.
There is. And you can see it in, you know, in the pandemic too. I mean, I do a lot on the pandemic as a sort of crystallization of his mm-hmm. approach to so many things. You know, one, minimize the crisis. It's smaller. It's going to be over. I'm going to get over it, etc. Hyper-personalize it. It's about me. Only I can solve it via diplomacy, or single-handedly bringing you a vaccine, right? But also demonize the experts. Anybody who disagrees, I'm smarter than them. A whole host of things. And of course, the difference about the pandemic is that if Americans can keep at arm's length a Ukraine crisis too far away, how does it really affect me? Mm-hmm. Even an Iranian nuclear program, clearly a threat, but far enough away, it's not affecting me every day. Pandemic arrives right on their doorstep. So they see the America First policy come right into their daily lives. Right. And that's the one that it just has to be impossible for folks to ignore.
Let's close out by pulling up to a different level here. I mean, what you've done is you have taken a very systematic, analytic approach to all of these major episodes involving national security and foreign policy, and even some relatively minor ones, which gives you a different way of looking at them all and getting the big picture. So back to the thesis here of the madman theory, and bear with me. Some claim that this really isn't a strategy, despite the post hoc rationalizations, that this is not really a conscious choice of the president's, but a, how do I put it, a disorder, or at least something outside of his choice, something uncontrollable. Having looked at this in this way, like few people have, where do you come down on that? Do you think that he has a choice to behave this way in foreign policy or not?
I think it's mostly accidental, frankly. He would like to claim it as some brilliant art of the deal. And I think there are times where he deliberately stirred the pot, hoping to gain advantage, calling a Taiwanese leader, perhaps. But the fact is that most of it happens, and again, based on accounts of folks who were there in the room with him or as it happened, happens in the moment, you know, based on a very confident, perhaps overconfident leader who doesn't make decisions based on information or intelligence, but often on gut feelings or the advice of informal advisors, etc. And that the policy is justified, backed up, and articulated after the fact, which is proof, frankly, or at least evidence, right, that it was not part of a plan. You know, I mean, again, you know, the withdrawals from Syria, there was no process in advance, happened afterwards. You know, even, you know, the third summit at the DMZ announced by tweet, you know, the policy process followed. So I think the record shows that it's largely accidental, a product of the way this guy operates. And then more consequentially, the record shows that on most of the prime national security challenges, it has at least gotten the U.S. in no better a position, and in many instances, in a worse position than it was 4 years ago.
Jim, thanks for sharing the fruits of this wide range of interviews and of this analysis with us in the book and in this conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Always good to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking the time.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to share the podcast, rate the podcast, and visit the Lawfare Store for your own Lawfare Podcast merchandise. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha Howell. Zachary Frank is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.